Today I'm going to read Nature in the Prelude. It is the fourth chapter. Nature's influence from the very dawn of life. The very subtitle of this great poem tells us that its main theme is the growth of a poet's mind. And if the mind of Wordsworth is the real hero, nature plays the most vital part. The grand second role in this unique autobiographical epic, her noble role is that of a vengeful mother, guardian, and nurse, exerting great elevating influence on the mind and the soul of the poet from the earliest dawn of his life. And this started from the earliest days when the poet was just a suckling babe in his mother's arm. So in the very first book we find how all his mental conflicts and contradictions and his sad failure to undertake the great task of composing an exalted poem on a novel theme send the poet's mind back to those infant days which he passed in the proximity of the river Derwent. And with what a deep emotion he addresses the river. For this didst thou, O Derwent, winding among grassy homes, where I was looking on, a wave in arms makes ceaseless music that composed my thoughts to more than infant softness, giving me, amid the fretful dwellings of mankind, a foretaste, a dim earnest of the calm that nature breathes among the hills and groves. Formative influence of nature from early childhood. The true significance of nature's role in molding the personality of the poet becomes crystal clear to us when he tells us how from the very childhood, in a very lovely and favorable environment, he was nursed and brought up by the various ministries of mother. Nature, with the help of her most lovely as well as the sublime and awe-inspiring sights and sounds. Fair seed time had my soul and I grew up, fostered alike by beauty and by fear, much favored in my birthplace and no less in that beloved vale to which ere long. We were transplanted. The point has been very nicely elucidated by the Logos and Kazimir when they say, to Wordsworth, nature appeals as a formative influence superior to any other, the educator of senses and mind alike. The sower in our hearts of the deeply stress of our feelings and beliefs. Ministry of beauty. To illustrate the ministry of beauty and fear, the different books of the prelude is replayed with various incidents of our spots of time. The count of exciting skating game on the ice relates very powerfully the poet's rather superconscious experience at the sight of one of the most beautiful visions of nature. When they were rapturously wheeling about wind through the darkness and the cold they flew. Nature of flame, a nature of pain or fear, bad and history. As regards the ministry of pain or fear, the incident of bird nesting and that of adventure in a stolen boat illustrate the contribution of fear to mental growth of the poet. Once at the dead of night, the boy Wordsworth, when a strong desire overpowered his better reason, stole away a woodcock which was the captive of another man's soil and after the commission of this undesirable deed. I heard among the solitary hills low breathing coming after me and sounds of distinguishable motion, steps almost as silent as the turf they trod. Stolen boat episode. The best illustration is probably that adventure in a stolen boat. It was an act of stealth. Troubled pleasure. And when the stolen boat started moving over the smooth surface of the lake, to his great dismay, he found a huge stick upreared his head. To the boy, it appeared like an awful and strange living being, with a will and power of its own following him with regular footsteps, with some fixed purpose. After his frightening incident, the poet, through the meadows, homeward went with a trembling heart and in pensive mood. But after I had seen that spectacle for many days, my brain worked with a dim and undermined sense of unknown mode of being over my thoughts. There hung a darkness, call it solitude or blank desertation or no familiar shapes. Remained no pleasant images of trees, of sea or sky, no colors of green fields, but hues that mighty forms that do not live. Like living men moved slowly through the mind by day and were a trouble to my dreams. Nature spiritualized. Next in the prelude, especially in the book 1 and 2, Wordsworth traces the growth of his love of nature and the various stages through which it passed. It may be noted here that Wordsworth spiritualized nature by making her a moral teacher. As a poet, this is his most important contribution, and here in lies his chief originality that is wonderfully revealed in his poetry of nature. Compton Rickett has rightly said it was Wordsworth's aim as a poet to seek for beauty in meadow, woodland and mountains, and to interpret this beauty in spiritual terms. He is ever spiritualizing the moods of nature and winning from them moral consolation, but the spiritual conception developed through various stages. First stage in the growth of poet's love of nature. In the first stage, his passion for nature was in its infancy and was kept enthused and nourished by his surroundings without any conscious and deliberate effort on his part. By nourishment that came unsought, this is the stage what we find mainly in Book 1. Here we find the poet drinking in a poor organic pleasure from the silver wraiths of curling mist or from the level fane of waters colored by the impending clouds. Second stage. The poet speaks about his second stage in the beginning of the second book. In the previous stage, he was almost totally interested in the exciting sports and pastimes and was not so much conscious of his natural surroundings. But now he seemed to have a conscious urge to have a nature collaterally attached to all their plans for all sorts of games and pleasures. But the time approached that brought with it a regular desire for calmer pleasures when the winning forms of nature were correctly attached to every scheme of holiday delight and every boyish sport, less grateful ails and languidly pursued. Third stage. Their boating excursions over the shadowy lake and their riding adventures on the galloping steed over hills and dales, through rough and smooth, brought the poet in closer contact with the charming and sublime aspects of nature. Slowly, Wordsworth's sympathies or spiritual powers enlarged, and familiar and common objects became dearer him day by day. He then began to love this sun not for its life-giving power, but because it bathed the hills in its radiant beauty at dawn and tossed the western hills with its golden figures before it set in the west. And here the poet very clearly speaks of another important stage in his attitude towards nature. Those incidental charms which first attached my heart to rural objects day by day grew weaker, and I hastened on to tell how nature intervened till this time, and secondary now at length was sought for her own sake. This third stage is a very important one of the important one in the development of Wordsworth's personality as a poet, as the high priest of nature. Final stage. In the final stage, we find the poet's attachment to nature growing into a religious love. At this stage, he has mystic visions and has had a feeling of the existence of a visionary power, a creative sensibility within himself, and has a realization of the unity and harmony underlying all the diversities of nature. When the poet is laid asleep in body, he becomes a living soul and can see into the life of things. He is now gifted with a plastic power and hence An auxiliary light came from mind, which on the setting sun bestowed new splendor, the melodious birds, the fluttering breezes, fountains that run on, murmuring so sweetly in themselves, obeyed a like dominion, and the midnight storm grew darker in the presence of my eye. Imagination, the poetic faculty par excellence. Thus slowly Wordsworth, through his sense experiences, has become creator and receiver both, has acquired that highest intellectual power, imagination. In the last book of the Prelude, the poet reveals it in its various aspects as the faculty of creation, the poetic faculty par excellence, and this poetic faculty par excellence is really the hero, the leading figure. The presiding genius of the Prelude, Wordsworth was deeply conscious of the power which fostered his genius, and when he probed into his sources and he found that it came to him originally through a special awareness of nature, it was there that a shaft opened which reached down to a new world of life. Professor Garrod has very nicely elucidated this point in the chapter on sense and imagination. The glory of the senses passes into a glory of the imagination, precisely being fastened into the affections. The vision of the senses melts and dissolves, but it melts into the revelation of permanent supersensual realities. In very impression of sense, Wordsworth conceives that there is present from the beginning an imaginative activity. Sense and imagination are two extremes in the scale of poetic or spiritual apprehension, but the higher faculty is always obscurely present in the lower. Nature as the best guide and teacher. Wordsworth also considered nature to be our best guide and teacher. To him, books were all dull and dreary. Probably we all can remember those oft-quoted lines. One impulse from a venerable wood may teach you more a man of moral evil and good than all the stages can. And at the end of the book too, also the poet addressing the mountains and the lakes tells us the same thing. If in my youth I have been pure in heart, if mingling with the world I am content with my own modest pleasure and have lived with God and nature communing, removed from little enmities and low desires, the gift is yours. Source of great comfort and strength. Furthermore, for Wordsworth, nature was an eternal source of great comfort and strength. When after the failure of the great hopes and ideals of French Revolution, the poet was passing through a strenuous mental and spiritual crisis, and when his mental horizon was darkened by doubts and disappointments, it was the lovely and peaceful surroundings of the Lake District that brought peace and solace to his dejected soul. From books 12 and 13 elaborately tells us how imagination and taste of the poet was impaired, and how it was restored in the company of Dorothy and Coleridge amidst the lovely hills and dells, stormy wind and the murmuring fountains, meandering rivers and mighty mountains of the beautiful Lake District of England. Conclusion. In conclusion, we may justly assert that Wordsworth has rightfully been called by the critics and readers like the high priest of nature, the harbinger of nature, or the worshipper of nature, as no other poet has understood nature as Wordsworth does. His treatment of nature is original and unique. To Wordsworth, nature is inanimate. Nature is a living and organic unit with a life and personality of its own. There have been greater poets than Wordsworth, but none more original, says Bradley. And to Abercrombie, his whole life belonged to nature, and nature to his poetry was what it was, Lucy, both lay and impulse.